Kristen, want to hear a joke?
Yeah.
Some more time of year.
I don't know.
You want to hear this?
Okay.
I'm telling you.
Why are cows so great?
Why?
Look, Ollie. I'll tell you.
Because they're outstanding in their field.
Someone once said to me, and I can tell you over and over again to leave the situation, but you won't. Not until you're ready. One day you'll wake up and you'll realize this isn't the way you want to feel anymore or ever again, and you'll be done just like that. And this is something that everyone needs to learn.
Today's word of the day is
malapropism.
Definition: the mistaken use of a word in place of a similar sounding one, often with unintentionally amusing effect. As in, for example, dance a flamingo instead of flamenco.
You're going to have sometimes low moments when you won't want to get out of bed. You just want to stay there. At times you won't want to come out the house. There are some times when things aren't going to go right that will catch you on the blind side that you did not anticipate. There are times when anything that can happen will happen. Murphy's Law will be knocking at your door. See, but the real challenge comes when you get knocked down. That's where the growth takes place.
I got a saying, life knocks you down, try and land on your back, because if you can look up, you can get up. You've got the power in you to do that. You've got something special. You've got comeback power.
You'll get knocked down, but you won't be knocked out. I'm unstoppable. This will not get me down. You'll be able to get to your feet again, be on the ropes, but you'll have a fast recovery rate when you work on yourself.
You have to make that attitude a part of your everyday life. Do the extra repetition. Run the extra mile. Go the extra round. Give the full measure. Fight against weakness. Against fear. Against time. And against decay. Fight back. Go down swinging. Give every day everything you've got. And when you face a challenge, remember this. You have nothing to lose. Stand up. Go forward. Go out in a blaze of glory, fighting with everything you've got, every ounce of energy, every bead of sweat, every drop of blood until your last breath.
Commitment. It means taking a stand. Taking a stand for you. It means delivering. It means coming through. When we put ourselves in a situation where we say we're going to do it, it puts you in another zone. The universe responds to the man or woman that refuses to be denied. That business that you want, that book you want to write, that dream that you have of controlling your destiny, that is yours. But you've got to be willing to stand there and face disappointment, not have support, be lonely, doubt yourself sometimes, be rejected again and again and again, and refuse to turn around until life gives it up.
Nothing can resist a person that has that kind of commitment.
From ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. Dozens are dead and over 100 wounded in a mass shooting and explosion at a Moscow concert hall. And now we're learning that the U.S. warned Russia something like this might happen.
The terrorist group ISIS is claiming responsibility for this attack. It comes just 2 weeks after the U.S. State Department warned about possible extremist attacks in Russia and specifically at concert venues, advising Americans there to avoid crowded areas. An official telling ABC News that the U.S. shared the intelligence with Russia that there was an imminent threat from ISIS.
ABC's chief global affairs correspondent, Martha Raddatz. The Princess of of Wales is asking for some time, space, and privacy for her and her family as she undergoes chemotherapy. Kate Middleton learned she had cancer after undergoing abdominal surgery in January.
Now, abdominal surgery and the association of abdominal cancer can be a wide variety of different causes. But what we do understand is that she's getting preventative chemotherapy. And the main goal of that is to prevent recurrence or prevent the chances of cancer coming back after removal. Obviously, we're hopeful that this is all successful for her.
ABC News medical contributor Dr. Darian Sutton. Investigators are determining whether charges will be filed after a mass casualty crash on a highway near Austin, Texas.
The bus was full of pre-kindergarten-age children out on a field trip to a zoo. A little boy was killed, as was a man in another vehicle. Texas Department of Public Safety Sergeant Dion Cockrell says the ages of the dozens of victims made it tough.
It's difficult. It's something we actually do for a living, but it's difficult when you find children this young that are involved in a crash.
Four victims had to be medevaced away from the scene. Alex Stone, ABC News.
Clock's ticking down on the Senate to avert a partial government shutdown. The House passed its funding package. You're listening to ABC News. A new study by the FTC takes a closer look at grocery stores and how they fared during the pandemic. And it turns out they did pretty well.
When grocery prices spiked during the pandemic, some of the country's biggest grocery store chains may have been boosting their own profits. A new report from the FTC says it appears prices at big chains rose faster than their profits. It also accuses some chains of price gouging during the pandemic.
ABC's Sherry Preston. If you own a Hyundai or a Kia, you may be hearing from the dealer soon. There are some major recalls to tell you about.
Automakers Hyundai and Kia recalling a combined 147,000 vehicles over damaged charging units. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says nearly 99,000 Hyundai Ioniq and Genesis models are affected, while 48,000 Kia EV6 models are under the recall, all made between October 2021 and March 2024. The problem is the integrated charging control unit, or ICCU, that may become damaged and stop charging the car's 12-volt battery, causing the cars to lose power while driving, increasing the risk of a crash. Derek Dennis, ABC News.
How's your bracket? ESPN.com says there are now just 10 perfect ones out of the more than 22 million it initially received. 1 hour to go till the Mega Millions drawing. At least 977 million up for grabs. If you win and you opt for the lump sum, you'll get $467 million. Good luck. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
The following program can be heard across platforms such as Amazon Music, Audible, Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcast. And with that being said, the Ace of Alone show starts right now.
Step I've ever taken in the wrong direction helped me get to where I am today and led to monumental moments in my life that I would not have got.
Well, good morning once again. It's August 30th, and this is Mind Chatter episode number 34, and this is a tough one for me to do, and it's very personal, very emotional, and for those of you who know me, I don't typically put my emotions and my personal business out there, but this is something that's very important, and I think it's time. A couple of things. First off, I've been battling some allergies or something the last few days, and so if I'm not speaking very well, if you hear me blow my nose or sniffle or whatever, please bear with me. Number two, my fiance Patty's probably going to listen to this at some point, and I don't want her to think I don't want her to feel a certain kind of way about what I'm about to present here today. It just feels like there's something that I have to do, and it's long overdue, to be honest with you. And it has to do with, I titled it Open Letter to Terry Jean, and for those of you who don't know, Terry is the mother of my firstborn daughter. And throughout this podcast, I'm not going to mention my daughter's name out of respect for her privacy. But Terry and I were together when we were very young, 17, 18 years old. And things ended very, very badly for us. And I mean, just to put it out there right in the beginning, I mean, it was my fault. I mean, I made a lot of mistakes. I made a lot of bad decisions. And this podcast today is kind of in response to that. There's a couple of layers of inspiration that kind of brought me to where I am right now, doing this podcast right now. The title Open Letter to Terry Jane is actually based on kind of a mock letter that I had written in 2016. And that was inspired by, I had two back-to-back dreams about Terry. And for a little backstory, I used to keep a dream journal for several years, like 8-9 years. And so I wrote down all my dreams. And this particular time period in March of 2016, I had two back-to-back dreams about her. At the time, Terry and I had not seen or spoken to one another in, gosh, probably 20 years or something. And for some reason, these two particular dreams that I had seemed to affect me in a way that even today, I have trouble explaining. And I grabbed my dream journal just a little while ago, and I read through the dreams that, you know, as I had written them down, and they don't seem particularly remarkable the way that I wrote them down, but I do recall at the time they seemed very profound, very significant for some reason, and I couldn't figure it out why that would be the case. And a few days later, I ended up writing this open letter to Terry Jean, and I'll get into that here in a little bit, but you know, it just, like I said, we were young, you know, teenagers, maybe that could partially excuse some of the things that happened back then, but, you know, she and I have never really had the conversation that, you know, a mature guy would have had. And another piece of inspiration that kind of brought me to today is Terry and I, and her husband as well. I mean, we're all friends on Facebook. She's married to actually one of my old high school friends from years ago. So she posted something on Facebook, and I was commenting on it, kind of giving her shit. And she ended up texting me, personal message, and said that she would love to get together someday face to face and just have a conversation and talk about, you know, some of the many things that were left unsaid all those years ago. And that was quite a shock to the system. And I guess this podcast is kind of a way of getting some of the things out that I've wanted to say to her for many, many years. And like I said, we haven't had that conversation yet. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know if she's ever going to hear this. You know, maybe I'll send her a link or something. I don't even know yet. I mean, I thought I had this all figured out, all scripted in my head, but it's a tough one for me. So, like, again, please bear with me. I'm going to try to get through it as best I can. Terry and I got together, like I said, when we were young. The first time I ever met her, she was I met her through a mutual friend of ours, Matt, and we went over to her house. I think it was like, gosh, sophomore year in high school or something. And we ended up going to her house. Her mom wasn't home, so she let us in. She wasn't supposed to have people in the house, kind of a thing. And we hung out for a little while. I mean, she was just, you know, beautiful cheerleader, you know, kind of way out of my league. But she was very cool, very down to earth. You know, she was very nice. And her mom came home early from work, so we had to skedaddle out the back door and jump the fence. And, you know, it's one of those things. And then kind of fast forward to a couple years later, I think it would have been, you know, senior year in high school. We went to rival high schools. And we used to always go to these dances on the weekends. And then, you know, the MO at that time was, you know, we'd go to these dances and then find out where the parties were. And then there was always somebody willing to buy alcohol for the underage kids. And, you know, so that's how Terry and I kind of got together. One particular night after a dance, we got wind of a party that was supposed to be going on, and then we jumped in the backseat of my best friend's car and then drove around trying to find this party. And she, you know, we couldn't find it, so we just ended up driving around. And she ended up falling asleep on my lap in the backseat. And, you know, from what she told me, you know, a while later, that she just appreciated that I didn't, you know, try to make any moves on her, and I was a perfect gentleman and all that. And keeping in mind, you know, she's this beautiful woman that I didn't think that I even stood a chance with. And I was, you know, I was the kid with long hair and into the rock music and, you know, that kind of thing. And it was almost like we came from two different worlds. But it wasn't long after that we started seeing each other and just, you know, hit it off amazingly well. And that's kind of how we kind of got our start. And again, this was kind of at the tail end of high school. So she and I dated for about a year at the end of high school and then shortly after high school around that time period. And she was great. She was not the first. She was not my first love, and she was not the first woman that I ever had sex with, but she was the first woman that combined the two. So it was a very emotional relationship for me. And, yeah, it's just one of those things that you just never forget. And, tumultuous, I suppose. And when you're younger, teenagers, you have a hard time controlling emotions, and so, you know, that did factor into it. And so anyway, I ended up writing this letter to her about 4.5 years ago now. So after I had these back-to-back dreams of her, and, you know, the way that our relationship ended, it was bad, but it was all my fault. I mean, I'm gonna go through this letter that I wrote to her, and I mean, you'll get to see why I've had this need for so many years to try to make amends and try to right the wrong, because it wasn't just Terry and I involved. I mean, we had a daughter, and. To be honest with you, I don't know how I could have handled the situation any worse. And so I'm going to read some of this letter that I wrote to her. And I wrote it in a format that it'd be something like if I had had it published in a newspaper, and hopefully she read it someday. I mean, that's kind of how I wrote it. And I'll jump in here and there, and I'll give a couple little edits because there's some things that I've learned since I wrote this. And I don't know, you'll see what I mean, but I'll start it out. It says, "It's been nearly 20 years since you and I have seen or spoken with one another, and yet I can't stop thinking about you." And again, this is right after the back-to-back dreams I had. There's so much going on in my head and in my heart that you can't even imagine. The reason you can't imagine because I was too much of a coward to tell you how I truly felt when I should have. My hope, by writing this open letter, at the very least, is to finally say the things I should have said so long ago. Now, she texted me just recently, a couple days ago, and said that she wanted to get together face-to-face and talk about some of the things in the past. And like I said, that's kind of what led me to do this podcast today. So I'll continue here. It says, although I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, what inspired me to write this letter were back-to-back dreams of you. Since those dreams a few days ago, I can't get you out of my head. I've dreamt of you many times over the years, but none of those other dreams have ever had the kind of effect on me. And it really feels as if those back-to-back dreams have a very heavy significance somehow, and I just can't seem to figure out why now. I think about you frequently, but this is different. Since those dreams, you are not just occasionally on my mind, but constantly. And at the time, that's all I could think about since those dreams was like she was on my mind constantly. And it's like somehow the floodgates holding back all of my old memories and feelings has just been ripped from its hinges. And I really am struggling on the inside to figure out why that would be. So where do I even start? I guess I should start with the obvious, the apology. And even though we were very young at the time, what I did to you was absolutely inexcusable. You don't deserve that kind of treatment from any man, but especially from me. And for what it's worth, Terry, I was so completely wrong. And from the bottom of my heart and with everything I have, I truly am sorry for what I have done. The way I treated you remains to this day to be one of my life's biggest regrets, and I wish so much that I could take it all back. The truth is that I have so much more to apologize for than just breaking your heart. I'm sorry for being so immature and insecure. I'm sorry for not believing in you. But most of all, I'm sorry for not being the grown-up that I should have been. I was a child when I needed to be a man, and I was a coward who didn't want to confront the situation and who was too scared to admit that I have gotten everything so horribly wrong. I will be forever haunted by my decision to turn my back on you, even as you pleaded with me to see things as they really were. And I will forever be ashamed and embarrassed by that 18-year-old kid that I used to be. Sure, we all make mistakes when we are young, but what I did was mean and hurtful, and it has some far-reaching consequences, reaching further beyond anything I could have possibly comprehended at the time. As is usually the case, life sure can be a funny thing. To be perfectly honest, Terry, I was so passionately and insanely in love with you. I mean, looking back, especially after what I did, I wouldn't be surprised if you doubted that last statement. But please believe me when I say that I have not felt that kind of passion since. And I have to put in an edit right there because I have found it again with Patty. So, and I believe it's because you have the one quality that I have always found the most appealing, and ironically, the one exceptional quality that I have not found since you and I went our separate ways. And again, until now. And that quality is acceptance. The fact that you love me for who I was. At the time, edit. You're the only woman who I've ever been with that just let me be me. You're the only woman who didn't demand that I become something I wasn't. And that, perhaps, is the rarest quality of all to find in another. Only I didn't appreciate it back then because I didn't know how rare and valuable that particular quality would turn out to be. And I don't think I could have identified it as such back then, much less put it into words. You're the only woman who I enjoyed spending all my time with, and yet never felt as if I needed a break or that we were smothering each other. And again, like I said, Patty's going to listen to this at some point. I don't want her to, you know, feel a certain kind of way. These are just a lot of old memories and stuff coming up. So back then, I didn't have any money. I didn't have any goals for the future to speak of. Your parents hated me. And I'm certainly not the best looking fella around, but you didn't care. You loved me anyway. I could just be myself when I was with you. And that's what made you so special to me. In my eyes, you were my world. You were perfect. I was so attracted to you. And I simply couldn't believe how someone as beautiful as you would even give me the time of day. You had the utmost attention And you clearly captured my heart. I was infatuated with you in every sense of the word. And I felt as if I was the luckiest guy to have walked the planet. Now, conventional wisdom says that teenagers like we were can't understand complex situations like love or relationships. And that young people don't have the mental capacity to understand the intricacies or the significance of powerful and complicated emotions. And I say horseshit. I've never bought into the conventional wisdom. There are differences between teens and full-fledged adults, of course. Emotional control, which I mentioned earlier, for example, is certainly more difficult for younger people. And a little story to that, emotional control. I remember we were at a house party, one of our mutual friends one night. And we had another friend who was, I think they had dated for a short time back in the, before us. And he was at this party and he had just enlisted in the Navy. And he was talking to Terry and proposed marriage to her at that party. And she told me about that. And I was like, what? I was like, and you said what? And she's like, well, I don't know. I'm still thinking. And I lost it. Ran out the door and I ran down the street and I was crying and ended up punching a van and I broke my hand. And it was just, you know, seems silly now, but at the time it was pretty emotional. But anyway, this guy knew full well that she and I were together and, you know, for him to do that kind of pissed me off. You know, the point being that, I mean, having trouble controlling an emotion is it's far different than having a lack of understanding of it. Inexperience is also a factor for younger people, as is a lack of vocabulary. I mean, but make no mistake, I knew exactly what I was feeling at the time, even if I couldn't put it into words. And I also knew that at the time you were all that I wanted. Now, conventional wisdom also speaks about things like, you know, raging hormones of teens and young adults, which supposedly makes it all but impossible to have a monogamous relationship. And again, I say horseshit. The old cliche, I only have eyes for you, was definitely true when we were together. Even though I was one of those horny 18-year-olds, right? I mean, full of raging hormones and a slave to my biological reproductive urges and all that. And despite rumors to the contrary, there was rumors that I had messed around on her, but it's never true. I mean, I was completely and happily faithful to you and only you. I mean, I literally could not see another woman the way that I saw you. And as far as I was concerned, I already had the best in you, and it didn't make sense to me to sneak around with someone else when nobody else could hold a candle to you. I mean, you were practically a goddess. So why tell you this, you know, 25 years later? I mean, why even tell you these things at all? I mean, to hopefully make you understand how I viewed you and how I truly felt about you back then. To hopefully make you see where my actions and my decisions came from. Not to provide justification, but to try to explain. And even though that I ended up being incredibly wrong, that I was completely devastated when I thought you had cheated on me when you went away to school in Miami. And that was the linchpin right there. And it wasn't the fact that you were pregnant, you know, with our daughter that drove me away. I mean, the idea of fatherhood never scared me. It was that I thought someone else was the father. And it was because I loved you and I adored you so much that I was so absolutely crushed by the thought of you with somebody else. And I'm not even sure that the words crushed or devastated truly do justice to what was actually felt in my heart at the time. I mean, you knew me pretty well back then, better than I would even like to admit today. I mean, I can clearly remember coming over to your apartment after you'd gone back home and we were split up and whatever, but And you played a song for me. And the song, I remember, was from a rock band from the 80s called Firehouse, and the song was Don't Treat Me Bad. And I didn't get it at the time. But that song was your plea to me to stop doing what I was doing to you. It was your attempt to send the message, as the song lyrics go, to pick up the pieces and start it all again. In other words, you're asking me to forget all of this nonsense so we could get back to the way it was before. You knew me well enough to understand that my love of music would be the best way to tell me what you wanted me to hear, what I needed to hear. And I understand now that you were literally begging me to come back to you, but I wasn't listening. I mean, yes, I heard the song, but I wasn't smart enough to pay attention to the real message. You know, not what the song was saying, but what you were trying to say. And even if I had been paying attention, I mean, honestly, the message would have fallen upon deaf ears. You were telling me you were willing to forgive me for being so stupid and so wrong. But that message never resonated. And it was because I thought you were the one who needed my forgiveness. You know, the truth is that I was so convinced I had it all figured out, that I had you all figured out, that I was the heartbroken one, that I was the victim, not you. I mean, so strongly did I believe that world of illusion and make-believe that I had created, that, I mean, it caused me to do some things that have completely changed my life's path, you know, and by extension, yours and our daughter's as well. And I was so angry because of what I believed that I wanted to get back at you, you know, to exact revenge of some sort, you know, to hurt you like you hurt me. And little did I know I was only making matters worse, but that's where my other kid's mom comes in. You know, one catastrophic mistake turned into another catastrophic mistake, and then another, and another, like dominoes. You know, I got with her directly out of my anger for you, and she was a one-night stand that, in all honesty, should have remained just that. Obviously, my other two kids would disagree, but she and I never had anything in common except for a birthday. I mean, we didn't belong together at all. And we were the epitome of oil and water. And I'm not trying to bash on her in this podcast, because if you were to ask her, she'd probably say the same thing. But looking back, I think at least part of her appeal at the time was that she was everything that you were not. She was like the anti-Terry. And if you were the perfect one for me, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that she was the worst thing for me. And our history bears that out. I mean, there are only two things that she and I ever got right, and that was our two daughters. And other than that, she and I are the worst relationship that either one of us have ever had. And I'm sure she would tell you the same. I mean, heck, she probably already has. I mean, she's very fond of trashing me to anyone who will listen anyway. But the next mistake was challenging paternity. I mean, I don't know why I couldn't have just believed in you. And I can remember your phone calls from house parties in Fort Lauderdale, where you tried to convince me that you weren't having any fun. And I also remember hearing, you know, the music bumping in the background, you know, people's voices all around you. I'm thinking about, you're in a house party in Fort Lauderdale. How are you not having fun? And a little edit here, but I did a podcast a while back on time travel and how everybody seems to have if they think about it, everybody has a crossroads in their past that they would like to go back to and kind of have a do-over. And in that podcast, I stated that phone call right there was my crossroads, because that's the one decision that I made that changed everything. And it was then that she told me she was pregnant, and that's why she wasn't having any fun. And of course, I jumped to the conclusion right away. You know, my thoughts were flooded by the incessant chatter of all the people who had been You know, who knew that you were in Miami and constantly telling me that long-distance relationships never work out, or that I should just move on because you're probably going to replace me with, you know, some Florida suntan beach guy anyway. And at the time, I mean, what was I supposed to think? I mean, would it have made it a difference if you would have saved the pregnancy news until you finished school and came back home? I mean, my mindset at the time, I doubt it. I mean, the only way this would have maybe turned out any differently is if you would have told me before you left. But then again, if you didn't know before you left, you know, then obviously it wouldn't have been a possibility. I mean, who knows? Maybe things happen for a reason. And maybe there's a reason, you know, we both had to go through this pain and suffering. And I still can't believe that I wouldn't even consider the possibility that you could have been pregnant before you left. And looking at it today, from when our daughter was born, if you just do some basic math, back 9 months, you know, she was still here. She was still home. But at the time, 18 years old, no emotional control. I was stupid. But regardless, I mean, you did the right thing by telling me, even though it was by phone over, you know, 2,000 miles away. I just don't know how I could have responded any worse. And all it would have taken on my part is a little bit of faith in you. But the problem was that I had no confidence or faith in myself. And it was this lack of faith that ultimately drove me to deny paternity. You should have seen me when the DNA tests were ordered. I mean, you should have seen how smug and arrogant I was during the blood draw. I just knew I was right. I just knew our daughter wasn't mine. Any doubts that I might have had, because we had to wait several weeks for the results. And I remember you invited me over shortly after she was born to come see her, which I did. But the first time I saw her and held her in my arms, I mean, she had dark complected skin, almost black hair. And for me, that solidified. I remember thinking, you know, aha, you know, yeah, keep on telling yourself that I'm the father. I mean, after all, at the time, we both had blonde hair and green eyes. There's no way that you and I are producing a dark complected black haired baby. It's genetically impossible. And again, another edit. That's part of the stupidity of a teenager. Somebody who just does not have wisdom, life experience. That was that kid talking. But the moment that I saw the test results is one of the most profound moments I've ever experienced. I mean, I still remember the number. I held on to the test results for a lot of years. I don't have them anymore, but I still remember the number. 99.97%. And that's almost a perfect genetic match. I mean, she was mine. And what I felt the instant that I saw the number, I mean, I can't even put it into words. And it wasn't because that number constituted evidence that she was mine or that I was a new father with responsibilities. It was because in that instance, in that moment, I knew how horribly wrong I had been about you. About everything. I mean, I knew right then what I had to do. I know what I should have done. And I don't want to make excuses, but I mean, it was an incredibly confusing and turbulent time for me. I mean, things weren't that simple anymore. The other woman was pregnant also with my second daughter, which complicated matters. So, I mean, if you figured it out, I mean, yeah, I was 18 years old and I had two women pregnant at the same time. Yeah. Talk about irresponsible. But I had a lot to digest at a very early age. I mean, as a 19-year-old, I had two virtual freight trains of responsibility barreling down on me from two different directions. I mean, what I should have done was to admit that I was wrong. I should have crawled back to you with my tail between my legs, you know, like the beat dog that I was. I mean, I should have taken my medicine and begged you for forgiveness. And I would have deserved any punishment that you wanted to dish out. But instead, I made another mistake. I chose to ignore all of the red flags and the warning signs with the other woman. I chose instead to stay the course with her, not realizing that I was sailing right into a Category 5 hurricane that would eventually basically rip my life to shreds. And on top of that, I mean, I missed out on one of the most precious moments that anyone could ever hope for, right? To witness the birth of their firstborn. I missed out on that. And I think my next mistake was allowing myself to exchange parenting rights of my daughter for the possibility of a better financial position. And when you called me out of the blue, I think she was 5 at the time. And you made the proposition because you're getting married to Craig, and he was offering to adopt her. And at the time, you know, the other woman and I had split up, and I was living with my brother in town, and did not have a lot of money. I was working a low-paying job, and I was being heavily garnished with child support on 3 children. I mean, you knew that. I mean, still, it was quite a shock to even hear you speak those words. And I guess I just never thought that you would ever ask that of me. However, I mean, the idea of getting rid of, you know, a third of my child support, you know, making my paychecks about 30% bigger. I mean, it was like candy to a sugar addict, right? I was having a tough time financially speaking. So your proposal couldn't have come at a more opportune time. I mean, who exactly was the better beneficiary of that proposal? I mean, the jury's still out on that one. I mean, I still can't decide if your proposal based on financial obligations coupled with less than one day to make a decision was either dastardly or sheer brilliance on your part. And I mean, I'm kind of leaning towards the latter, like I mentioned before. I mean, you knew me very well. You knew that if I had too much time to think about it, I would have done the right thing and told you no. And still, it was my decision. I could have said no. And yeah, I did eventually go on to mildly improve my finances. But it could very well be the dumbest thing I've ever done. Although I can hardly fault you, you know, for that. I mean, you were, like I said, you were with Craig, trying to close an ugly chapter from your past and move on. And in my own mind, I try to justify my decision to essentially give my child to another man by telling myself that it was for the best, you know, that you and Craig could give her a better, more stable environment, or that I didn't see her very much anyway, or, you know, that she would still want to come see me no matter what the paperwork said, blah, blah, blah. It was all a bunch of crap. I mean, the real reason, and this is very hard for me to say this, the real reason I let her go, as much as it pains me to say this today, is because I was afraid of confronting you. And as long as she was a tie that bound you and I together, the possibility would have always existed that we would one day have to talk about what happened between us. And I may not have been able to articulate it back then, but I lost her, not because of a better financial position, a better environment for her, or a lack of visits. It was because of fear. Because I was just plain afraid to look you in the eye and tell you that I had screwed everything up. Afraid to ask you for forgiveness, and afraid to acknowledge that I had failed you both. Now, I mean, a lot has happened, and you know, it's 28, 29 years now. She's 28 now. I mean, we both gone our separate ways and, you know, lived our lives. I mean, life's a funny thing, you know, and the universe is a crazy place. And I don't know if you know this or not, but karma actually exists and it's everywhere. And I thought I knew what the basic concept of karma was all about, but I mean, recently I've been forced to kind of rethink my position. And I'm sure you've heard about me, you know, some of the accusations I was accused of and the unexpected journey I took for a number of years. Regardless, I don't know. It's a tough one, you know. You know, when I had the accusations came out, I mean, everybody I knew automatically assumed it was true. Everybody distanced himself from me, avoided me like the plague. I mean, everyone, including my brother, my best friend, turned their backs on me or turned against me. And all the people that I thought were my friends and loved ones began inventing and spreading ridiculous stories about me. Some of the shit I heard over the years, oh my God. And perhaps the hardest part for me to take was that not even one single person, not even my own mom, even asked me if it was true. Not one. You know, so what does that have to do with anything? I mean, karma. That's what I was getting at, karma. It wasn't until I had those back-to-back dreams that I figured out that the situation with you and I and the situation about my unfortunate journey are eerily connected. And because of the situation I went through, I now understand how you must have felt when I turned my back on you and hurt you like I did. The two situations are almost mirror images of each other in that sense. And all of those people from my past did exactly the same thing to me that I did to you. Right? They didn't need any facts or explanations or proof. And because of that, you know, that pain and that betrayal are very real things to me now in a way that they simply weren't before. And now I know how it feels and how you must have felt. And with this understanding comes an even greater sense of shame and embarrassment for what I have done to you and our daughter. I mean, if the parallel between the two situations constitutes karma, then karma has taken a mighty big chunk out of my ass. And if someone... one of the underlying things of karma is to force someone into learning a lesson or an opportunity for growth. And then, I mean, I got to tell you, like I said in the text the other day, I hope you believe me, that I've matured and I've grown a lot over the years. I mean, we're 48 now, and that's partly a direct result of karma, I suppose. I guess you have to say that it works. I mean, however, I didn't write that open letter to you to express how much I've grown or matured over the years. I wrote it and I got on this podcast today because after all of these years, you've never heard me say I'm sorry. I wrote the letter because what I did to you all those years ago is a wrong that has never been righted. And it's something that I've neither forgotten nor forgiven myself for. And although I'm normally content to let the past be the past and just move forward, and this is just something that's been eating me away on the inside like a cancer, I mean, for years. You know, the old cliche, that if I could go back in time knowing then what I know now, I mean, it certainly applies. And like I said about the crossroads that everybody has, you know, everybody has a pivotal crossroad, you know, where they wish they could return and, you know, choose option B rather than option A. Or, you know, like I said, for me, it's that phone call where you told me you were pregnant. I mean, that's my crossroad. That's the precise point in time where I wish I could have a do-over. You know, and I'm not asking for a do-over. In all honesty, I don't even know what to expect from this. I don't know. I mean, at the time when I wrote the letter, I didn't know where you were. I didn't know if you were single, married, you know, what. I didn't know. I know now, but, you know, so it was very encouraging a couple of days ago when you texted me and asked if we could get together face to face and talk about some of the stuff. And you know, this whole thing, this the letter, the podcast, the dreams, all that, finally being able to actually say it out loud, somewhat cathartic for me, somewhat therapeutic, I suppose. I mean, there's a lot of things I've been holding in for a long, long time now. And I honestly do hope that we get the opportunity to just hash it out. And I don't know if you're going to hear this. Like I said, maybe I'll send you a link. Maybe somebody else that we both know will listen to and go, hey, Chris made this podcast, you know, check it out. I don't know how it's going to go down. I don't know. And I don't know when we're ever going to see each other, anything like that. But I sincerely am sorry for the way I treated you. And three lives could have been a hell of a lot different had I had been more mature and more of a man instead of a coward. So I don't even know what to say now. I think that's where I'm going to leave it. Like I said, this is an unusual podcast for me. I don't put my personal stuff out there, my emotions like that. And this is a hard one, but I see my Aunt Patty's on here. I appreciate you tuning in. But this is a rough chapter. And to anybody else who's going to listen, I'm going to upload this here in a few minutes. But anybody else who might listen, you get quite an insight as to how my adult life started out. And I'm just going to leave it there because I'm getting kind of choked up. So everybody have a great Sunday. Thanks for tuning into Mind Chatter. And we'll be back next week with another one. So thanks. Have a great Sunday.
Claiming responsibility. I'm Lisa Lacera, Fox News. An offshoot of ISIS says it carried out the attack on a concert hall in Moscow. Russian news agencies say that more than 60 people were killed and more than 140 hurt when several men started shooting, then set the building on fire as the White House gathers information about the attack.
The images out of Moscow are hard to watch, White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby says.
There's some moms and dads and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters that haven't gotten the news yet. And this is going to be a tough day. So our thoughts are with them.
Kirby says so far there does not appear to be a link between the attack and Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
There is no indication at this time that Ukraine or Ukrainians were involved in the shooting.
Earlier this month, the U.S. Embassy in Moscow warned Americans to avoid large gatherings because of reports extremists had imminent plans to target the city.
Fox's Jared Halpern at the White House. The U.N. Security Council condemned the attack, calling it heinous and cowardly. The Senate has less than 2 hours to pass a package of bills that would avoid a partial government shutdown, and they don't appear to be any closer to taking a vote than they were this afternoon. After the House passed the bill earlier today, a motion was filed to remove the House Speaker.
Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has filed a motion to vacate against House Speaker Mike Johnson.
The Republican Speaker of the House handed over every ounce of negotiating power to Chuck Schumer and the Democrats.
Greene is among several Republicans angry with Johnson's decision to pass the massive government funding bill she believes lacked conservative priorities on spending and border security.
Fox's Ryan Schmelz on Capitol Hill. If the motion goes to the House floor, it would likely happen next month when Congress returns from recess. Britain's Princess Kate breaking her silence, announcing she's being treated for cancer. America is listening to Fox News. Prosecutors release evidence detailing what they're calling horrific abuse by a Utah parenting blogger.
Footage shows the moment Ruby Frankie's 12-year-old son turned up to a neighbor's home asking for help after escaping Jody Hildebrandt's home. Officers describing the boy as emaciated, later finding Frankie's 10-year-old daughter also malnourished inside Hildebrandt's home. The Washington County District Attorney's Office also releasing interrogation tapes, crime scene photos, and records Frankie kept documenting what officials call religious extremism. Prosecutors say the kids were denied food, water, and beds. Frankie and Hildebrand, who ran an now-defunct YouTube channel on parenting, pled guilty to 4 felony counts of aggravated child abuse and were both sentenced to 4 1-to-15-year terms in prison. Kristen Goodwin, Fox News.
North Carolina's highest court has declined to revive a challenge to the decision by city leaders in Asheville to remove a downtown monument honoring a Civil War-era governor in 2021. The state Supreme Court agreed unanimously it had been appropriate to dismiss legal claims filed by an historic preservation group that had helped raise money to restore the statue. Low-wage workers have seen an increase in pay, though that increase doesn't tell the full story.
The lowest-paid workers in the U.S. economy are being paid more, but the Economic Policy Institute tells MarketWatch the gains over the past 4 years are not enough, and wages remain grossly inadequate. The worker shortage of recent years gave employees more leverage, which boosted pay even in low-paying industries like fast food. Though the economists say low-wage workers are still not paid enough to make ends meet. The report says some low-wage workers are better off than before the pandemic, but wages are only one dimension, and you might still really be struggling.
Fox's Jenny Casola. I'm Lisa Lacera. This is Fox News.
If you guys enjoyed that episode, do me a favor. Leave me a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Audible. Or however many stars you think I deserve. And until next time, I'll catch your asses down the road.
Grab a clue, what could that be? They tell me that I'm never gonna make it. They want me to do something that can make sense. They hate when I keep dreaming I'll be famous.
But I don't give a fuck, I'm gonna keep chasing.
They tell me that I'm never gonna make it. They want me to do something that can make sense. They hate when I keep dreaming I'll be famous.
But I don't give a fuck, I'm gonna keep chasing.
I think this life could be special if I get rid of the devils. They think that I am a rebel. I think they want me to settle. There's nobody on my left.